take a little risk. Send lawyers, guns, and money. Dad, get me out of this. Ha!
Welcome, everybody, to episode 72 of the Matt Jones Podcast, the fourth one since we restarted it. I'm happy to be joined by someone. This is the first person I've had on in a while that I don't really know, but I feel like what better way to meet somebody than via a podcast that everybody's listening to. Mina Kimes. Mina, thank you very much. You're in Los Angeles. I'm actually in New York visiting my girlfriend, so we're on opposite sides of the country, but I appreciate you doing it.
Thank you for having me on.
Now, well, first of all, I'll start with this. The young women that work for KSR are as about as excited to have you on as anyone we've ever had. Normally when I book these guests, nobody says anything, but Maggie and a couple of the others have written me like, I cannot wait to hear Mina. So I'll start with this. You know, you have done so many things that are kind of the first for women in the industry. Does it make you feel good that young women wanting to break into sports sort of look up to you like that?
Yeah. I mean, I'm not going to lie, hearing that certainly does make me feel good. It makes you feel a little bit better about, you know, just showing up and talking about sports for a living at a time like this, when it can feel relatively insignificant. Although I would argue, actually, at this particular time, it's far from insignificant. I think it's pretty significant, and I'm sure we'll get to all of that. But I'm so excited to meet young women, because a lot of times people ask me, you know, did you want to get into sports? Did you want to, whenever I take on a new role, just as an analyst or a commentator, people ask me if that's something I aspire to do. And I always tell them the truth, which is no, it's just not something that ever occurred to me. So.
Well, I'm interested in how you got into it, because you do many things for ESPN, but you host The Daily, a daily podcast that's really good in terms of finding a unique story to start. And we'll get to that in a minute. But your background, I was a lawyer before this. Your background was doing finance stuff, right? Wasn't your first job for Forbes? Like, how did you end up doing sports?
Yeah, I was a business journalist out of college for about 7 years. I worked at a small business magazine, then I worked at Fortune for a while, writing about finance. And then I became an investigative reporter, writing just, I guess, deep dives into corporations doing bad things for the most part. And then I went to Bloomberg, where I wrote for Business Week. And it was then that ESPN approached me and asked me to write about sports. They got the idea.
How did they even know to do that? Yeah. That's kind of odd to me. Like, you're writing like investigative corporate journalism work, and ESPN goes, listen, let's just switch gears. Like, how did they even come to do that?
They had a couple clues, I suppose. One was that while I was kind of this hardcore business writer, you know, writing takedowns and hedge funds, that kind of thing, my Twitter feed was mostly dumb football memes and live tweeting games. So that was a clue. And then I wrote a personal essay that was published in Slate about football. So they knew that it was something that was interesting. I don't think they knew the depths of my interest, the fact that it, you know, was something I was investing pretty much all my free time into, you know, spending time on message boards, that kind of thing.
But you were a message board person. So was I. Like, that's people about 10 years younger than us. That makes us sound 90 when we talk about message boards. But I was a message board person too.
I just hope no one finds anything I posted.
What was your handle? I was McGlore52. What were you?
Oh, man. I don't know. This is before I got my dog. Otherwise, it might be like Lenny's mom. Probably it was definitely something Seahawks related. Because this is all Seahawks stuff. That's always an interesting path too in sports. Cause you know, until I got to ESPN, I was pretty myopic. I was pretty focused on football in particular in Seattle. And I've had to obviously expand that since then.
You know, the Seattle Seahawks are obviously your favorite team. I went to law school with a guy named Teddy Werner, whose dad's Tom Werner, that owned the Red Sox and all that for a little while. And he was a Seahawks fan. And until you came along, he was the only Seahawks fan I had ever encountered in my entire life.
Really?
So, he used to love Steve Largent. Everything was Steve Largent, Steve Largent. You're probably a generation below that, but your passion for the Seahawks probably rivals a lot of my listeners for Kentucky.
Yeah, I got a Steve Largent jersey in my shelf over there. That's another thing. I stopped buying jerseys, I think, once I started working at ESPN.
But you know, nowadays you guys are allowed to admit some of that stuff. Like you're allowed to admit, I don't know, that didn't used to be the case, but you're like, everybody knows you're a Seahawks fan. Bam Pelt's a Maryland fan. Like it feels like people admit that more.
Yeah. And most of the time I'm just complaining about the Seahawks and their approach, I suppose, towards football these days. So yeah, I don't think I'm definitely a homer, you know, when I'm watching games, but I try not to let it leak into my analysis.
Well, I want to talk a little bit. When I asked you to do this, it was a week ago, which honestly feels like a millennium ago. I mean, the last 2.5 months have been wild. But when I asked you, I wanted to talk about you and football. And then, of course, even in the last few hours with what's happened with Vic Fangio and with Drew Brees, everything has changed. Do you get a sense that in this time we're in right now, we just aren't going to accept that athletes can stay silent about issues, that like, and if they talk, what they say is going to be of the utmost importance? Is that kind of where we are right now?
It sure feels like it. I do think this sense of kind of, you know, we're keeping track of, okay, which team's making a statement right now? What are they saying? Did they use the words police brutality? How vague are they being? Are they committed to some sort of action? I think that is restricted to social media a bit, but I think what we're seeing with Brees in particular is, while I think, you know, some of these athletes can probably get away with not saying a lot in terms of public opinion, right? And being vague and posting a black square and having that be it. Their teammates are noticing. And when you're the quarterback of an NFL team or the coach of a college football team, like Dabo is the other name in the news today, that counts. That matters. It matters a great deal. I think of Jim Dolan and the New York Knicks and his employees coming forward, not coming forward, you know, anonymously saying, what the hell's going on, man? That's a guy who has to go out and sign free agents, right? I mean, this is a sport. These are all sports, in particular, though, football and basketball, that are predominantly black. And that dynamic, that sort of reality is, I think, inflecting the way in which not only everyone reacts to this, but the ramifications of that. And Brees is certainly feeling that today.
Do you worry, like, okay, so take Brees's comment. You know, it's funny how the whole Kaepernick situation in 4 years has really, in my opinion, I don't want to say flipped, because he had a lot of supporters when it happened, but I won't say he's unanimously popular, but he is like, he has looked a lot better to a lot of people in hindsight, because the idea was, well, you didn't like a silent protest, so now what do you like? I was really surprised by Bree's comments, because it felt like there was almost no, like, nobody argues today that, except crazy people, well, people gonna get mad at me for saying that, but a lot of people don't, people recognize that Kaepernick was not protesting the military or the flag, et cetera. Yeah. And Brees almost went back in time to make that argument, which I found odd.
Right. Yeah, I think that that's what's, why it was so poorly received. I mean, you're so right about how much this has evolved, how the center, I keep saying the center has moved on this, as I see.
That's a good way to put it. I think you're right.
Speaking up. In 2017, I did a cover story for ESPN the magazine on Aaron Rodgers, and I asked him about Colin Kaepernick, and he said he should be in the NFL. That made news. That was like a big fucking deal at the time, because no white athletes, much less, you know, the greatest quarterback in the league at the time, were commenting on him. And the fact that he was, you know, not being given a job, setting aside his protest. Although Aaron also acknowledged the intent of the protest at the time. Now, I think, you know, things that were viewed as controversial, frankly, by white people back then, are not seen as controversial right now. Again, the center has moved, and Drew Brees has found himself in the extreme on this issue. And I think what's frustrating, Matt, to so many people is he didn't have to agree with the protest. Now, I personally think, if you actually look at, I don't know how many times we have to explain this and relitigate it, how Kaepernick landed on the decision to kneel. Obviously, you know, he was advised to do so by Nate Boyer, veteran, and it was not intended ever to be a sign of disrespect. He's freaking kneeling, man. Like he's kneeling. I still don't understand why that gesture, which is literally genuflect, like it's a subservient gesture, why that, you know, is being interpreted that way. But setting, even if you've decided, okay, a lot of people in the military who I, you know, agree with, they think this is the wrong way to do it. Even if Breeze feels that way, he could have still said he understood. He has heard what so many athletes have said about the intent of the protest, and he did not. And I think that's why people are so frustrated today.
You know, it's interesting you say the center's move, because I think you're totally right about that. So in Kentucky, a lot of people would consider me sort of on the left. I'm probably in the social media world kind of in the center, because social media, I think, especially Twitter, even sports writer Twitter goes pretty far left. And I will just even use my thing. So I never thought it was like he didn't have a right to do it. I never thought it was some terrible thing. But my argument was always, I wish he wouldn't do it like this because it's counterproductive. And then I had Bomani, our mutual friend, say, he saw me say something like that on Twitter. And he was like, well, dude, it's not your choice. Like, you don't get to tell him what is the right way to express stuff. And Bomani was exactly right, as he usually is. Now, 4 years later, I'm not sure I would have even thought what I thought 4 years ago, that it wasn't the right way to express. In many ways, it was the exact right way to express what he wanted, because it got people's attention. And I think one of the things we've seen about all this is, and this is a sad reality of the country, the reason it moves is the violence. Peaceful protests, people almost don't listen to, which if Kaepernick just protests silently and doesn't kneel, I'm not sure anybody would have paid any attention to anything he said. What do you think?
Yeah, I think I've been wondering that too. Why has the center moved on this? Why have like hashtag Black Lives Matter again? If a white athlete had tweeted that in 2016, we would have been like, whoa, what is happening?
I mean, Joe Biden just used a Black Lives Matter sign in one of his ads. Could you have imagined that 3 or 4 years ago?
It has been so normalized. So then there's the question of how did this happen? And I think the reasons are complicated. I do agree. You know, all of these protests have played a huge role in that. I also think the culmination of these videos sort of implanting themselves in the American psyche, and the fact that there have been so many of them, that there's been no gray area, especially with, you know, the latest three incidents, killings. I just think at some point that just adds up. Right. I mean, I at some point it becomes undeniable. And I think we've been talking a lot about these statements and these team statements and whether they matter and whether they're kind of bullshit and banal and, you know, toothless and all that. And I think a lot of them are. But I still think they matter, because a big part of the reason why NFL teams were uncomfortable signing Colin Kaepernick, one, you know, was ideological. A lot of the owners genuinely are find themselves, you know, in opposition to him, but also economic cowardice. A lot of them felt this is going to cost us. Now, and by the way, I think Nike, which backed him, felt the opposite way. They felt like, okay, they got some praise for, I think, being on the right side of history of that, but I think they also cannily saw our fans, our consumers are on this side. We are selling to them. Now we're at a moment where owners and teams are economically fearful of the opposite. I think they are afraid, I'm not going to say, of not signing Kaepernick, but they're afraid of saying nothing right now. And these are all, you know, businesses, and they're motivated by the bottom line. I do think it's meaningful that you look across the landscape and you see corporations lining up to be on this side.
I find that fascinating too, that your center moves, that may be where it's moved the most. Just the idea that people just like businesses, if you're not on the sort of right side of history, people are not going to accept you at all. Let me go back for a second with Breeze, or who just for sake of this conversation, give me one or two of your athletes you really like, just as a person or as a player, whatever.
Like who I've written about maybe?
Yeah. Just who you like. Yeah.
I can tell you some of those. Yeah. I did a story a couple years ago on Jalen Ramsey. I really enjoyed him.
All right, so let's take Jalen Ramsey. I listen to only a handful of podcasts. I've started listening to yours after you were on the NFL show with me one day. I listened, but one of the things I've always listened to is Bill Simmons, and he had Ryan Russillo on Monday, and I was listening. And I like those two guys, and I heard Russillo start talking, and as he started talking, I knew he was going in the wrong direction. I could hear it. I wanted to get in there and stop him, and he kept going, and now he's getting a lot of criticism for it. And I found myself disappointed in him. I'm like, I've liked you all these years, man. How are you going to do this right now? If Jalen Ramsey, for me, it was Bill Simmons, Ryan Russillo, but if Jalen Ramsey said something like what Drew Brees said, I know that's a weird scenario, but if he did, would it make you
think the white athlete?
Yeah, but would it make it harder for you to cheer for him?
Yeah, but that's happened to me before.
Oh, has it?
Saying like something like that. I mean, so many athletes, you know, have.
But like for a political
opinion. Let's talk about Pete Carroll. Let's talk about Pete Carroll. Yeah, because he's in the news today. You know, on his pod, he did a pod also on The Ringer with Steve Curry. He's got a pod, and they had Greg Popovich on, and he talked about Colin Kaepernick, and you know, just said that he led the way in a lot of ways, and we owe a lot to him. And a lot of people pointed out correctly, you guys considered working him out. You didn't, right? You know, as other people pointed out, Pete Carroll brought in Jordan Peterson to talk to the team, which was, you know, obviously a bit controversial. Don't have to get into all that. But I do think constantly, like, you know, when an athlete, a coach, a figure in sports you admire, they choose a path or an action that you that runs counter to your beliefs. And I think of examples that go beyond like ideological things, you know, actions also.
Yeah.
I think we can think of tons of examples like that. It does sting. It hurts. It affects, because we're like, we do root for these athletes as complete human beings, not just as chess pieces on the field, and these coaches. And I think we think about them holistically.
So I have probably, maybe not most of the people that listen to this podcast, because it's a little bit of a different audience, but most of the people that listen to my radio show are politically and ideologically different than me. It's probably 75% conservative Trump voters, and they know they're listening to a progressive. And it's been a, I always say, I'm not sure how many radio shows in the country have a known progressive with that many conservative listeners and how that works. And I think a lot for a lot of my listeners, as they hear me express some of that stuff, they get disappointed. Most of them still stick with me. Some of them don't. But I really am a big believer. Try to put the politics to the side and see what we have in common. Do you think you, and not just you, but do you think we're getting to a point that that's becoming harder to do for our athletes? For instance, let's say that tomorrow, you know, I don't know who the young quarterback, but Patrick Mahomes comes out as a Trump supporting Republican. I really think now that would hurt his career. Do you?
Yeah, I do, because I think we're at a unique moment in American history where politics used to be something that both sides felt like they could compartmentalize. And I don't, and yes. I'm not speaking universally. I think certain groups have never felt that way. I think a lot of minorities in this country, given, you know, how they've been affected personally by political decisions, cannot feel that way. But I do think in the past, we're talking about generally speaking, and this does include a lot of minorities as well. I think politics and political affiliations were viewed very differently. They weren't seen as all-encompassing. They weren't seen as one's identity, perhaps, in the way that they are now as a consequence of what's happened in government in this country over the last 4 years. And
you think it's going to be like that forever? Or do you think, you know, I mean, or is it just like, it's just the uniqueness of kind of the Trump moment, but, or do you feel like it's that way forever?
I don't think it'll be that way forever. Honestly. I'm not one of those people who, you know, believe, oh, everything's just going to be returned to normal. It's going to be like, you know, this post-apocalyptic scene where like the new utopia. I don't feel that way at all. But I just do believe this moment in history is that unique where, you know, it's no secret that things are more polarized than they've ever been. And I mean, God, Matt, it can't be more polarized now, right? That's literally impossible. Is there any world in which that's even possible?
We did have a civil war. I think it was pretty polarized then too. But I mean,
that's true.
You know, I don't know. Here's what I think has changed. And I do think this isn't just politics. I think it's sports. I don't care what position you have in this world. You can find someone online now to validate it. And I think that is what has really changed. I think you used to have fringe positions and you didn't really, unless you were in a city with lots of other people that had your position, you kind of like, you know, if you're a racist, you were one of a handful of racist people in your area. But now you can go online and whatever you think, there are going to be a lot of other people that think it. And I think it not only validates it, I think it reinforces it, makes you think your position is the majority. I mean, I'm amazed how many Trump supporters write me and say, you know, he's going to win in a landslide in November, right? And I'm like, he didn't win in a landslide last time and he's down. But like, they believe that because in their world, no one's against Trump. So how in the world would he lose? I think online has made the divisions even stronger. And I worry that that won't go away.
I think you're right. I think the internet and the way we communicate now and the communities contained therein are only serving to reinforce the division that we spoke about, right? And so you're probably right. That's never going to help. I also think, though, it's not just about community. It's not just about finding people who agree with you and affirm your positions, right? And we read that a lot. We read about like Facebook and how if you look at the top 10 articles, they're not like news outlets and people are just reading things that they're reinforcing what they already believe and all of that. But I also think people are logging on to fight. I think social media also exacerbates division, not just because you're finding your beliefs validated, but also you're being reminded of how polarized the other side is, which then encourages people to want to double down. Even if in a normal situation, in a world without that, in a world where people were just reading the newspaper and watching TV, like that, I actually think TV is not a good example because of cable news. In a world in which people used to just read the newspaper, you might be more open to changing your mind. I think, unfortunately, social media has made people less likely to change their mind because of the reason you just described, where you're encountering communities who agree with you, but also because changing your mind means taking an L, and nobody wants to take an L on the internet these days.
I think you're right. And I think it is very hard to be moderate or nuanced on the internet. I think those two things are really shunned by people. Like, I mean, when you write a column or in your case, when you do a podcast, you can be nuanced. That's one of the reasons I like a podcast form, is like a conversation like this can be nuanced. You can't be nuanced on social. There's no nuance. I mean, you take one tweet and if it's just got a couple words wrong, like you're in the ringer at that point. And I actually think both extremes sometimes have more respect for each other than the people in the middle. You know, I think like the Mitt Romneys of the world and the Joe Liebermans are the least liked people at times now. And I do think that's a very 2020 thing. I hope that changes, but I will see.
I hope so too. I don't know. I worry a lot about the way, forget politics. I worry about the way social media is changing the way we watch things, we read things, we express ourselves when everything is a performance. Wow, this is getting a little bit too deep, but I worry about not only our capacity to have our minds changed, but also to our capacity to authentically be ourselves and express our opinions about anything. So,
well, I appreciate it. Like, I like conversations like that. I know that probably wasn't what you signed up for when you came. So I'll talk a little. We'll switch to some football. You think we play this year? And if we do, let's talk about the NFL first. Do you think we play?
Yeah.
If we do, how many people are going to be there?
I do think we play. I want to say that looks like where things are going. Although, again, we never know what will happen if there's the second wave that they've been warning about, or just guys testing positive. You know, I was just talking to, I have two podcasts. I have the Daily Show, and then I have my own football show, which is very football-y. And I had Andrew Siciliano, my friend who hosts Red Zone, on today. And we were talking about this because we did preseason last year. He did for the Rams. And we were talking about, you know, this year and preseason, which looks like it's happening. And we both were just kind of like, wow, this is actually like these optional games that some coaches don't even want to play, don't play their starters. They are happening as of now. And that's remarkable because I don't think people understand the sheer number of human beings required to execute an NFL game, irrespective of whether there are fans in attendance. And it's quite an undertaking, as we discussed, like the NBA and MLB plans. It's been in the back of my mind. But by all accounts, the NFL is moving full speed ahead.
Well, let's talk about the Rams preseason, because you had to have been part of one of the most watched local preseason games ever when you were the very first female color commentator for a game. And, you know, again, I like to – people at ESPN always kid me that I make everything about Kentucky. But I will make this about Kentucky. We just had a passing a couple weeks ago of Phyllis George, who was the first woman to be on any NFL broadcast. And – that was such an honor, and I watched, and you crushed it. Not that I was surprised, but
I was
you
so did. Bad.
No. Listen, you were nervous, but after like a quarter, like my point is, you knew as much about it as anybody else, and there wasn't a sense of like I just was proud of you from afar, and I don't even know you. But what was that like? And do you feel like that sense of of history? I mean, like, you know. Phyllis George, I don't think, probably thought when she said on the NFL Today set that 35 years later when she passed away, that would be the first line of her obituary. But it was, you know.
I absolutely loved doing it. And Andrew, who was on the podcast, became a really close friend of mine during this process, because it really is an intense experience. And I loved it because, like I said earlier, I just love football. I never thought I would be in a position to weigh in on it, to be an analyst, which is relatively a new phenomena, right? Traditionally, women have been hosts and reporters. So I never thought that was something I'd be able to do.
Not relatively. It was completely new. It was not relatively, completely new.
Yeah. And so to be offered the opportunity, I wanted to say no, because I thought I couldn't do it, which is something women do a lot, by the way, when we feel unqualified for. If only we could have a little bit of that male confidence sometimes when you're unprepared for something. But my agent said, you should do this. And it's fun, because it really is unlike, you know, I do live shows with us. A lot of my shows are pre-taped. Some of them are live. And that's fun, because it is a rush, right? You know, from being on the radio, anything can happen, but nothing really compares to working a game. It's the closest we dorks can get to playing in a game. And it's just such a thrill. You know, it's a unique experience. I also had never been embedded with a team like that. So just to learn, oh, this is how a team gets from point A to B and from, you know, and executes. And I really relished, I guess, being on the inside and getting to see that happen. So it was a fun experience.
I did like 7 years ago. There were two Kentucky games that, because of the weirdness of the schedule, they weren't on any network. They were only on the computer. And I did color commentary for them. And I was not qualified, just, you know, what I found doing it was the things that seem so natural when you're watching at home, like, well, of course you would say that. In the moment, it's a lot harder to come up with that stuff than it is on your couch. Did you find that?
Well, yes. And then also imagine it's preseason. So first of all, Sean McVay doesn't play any of his starters. So yeah. I'm like, oh my God, that's a linebacker from like Delaware who's like undrafted. I'm trying to remember fucking something about him. And also the playbook. I remember I read an entire a book about the Rams offense. I'm a big Shanahan fan. I've spent a lot of time sort of thinking about speaking about Mike Shanahan, his offenses, and then his coaching tree and their offenses, and the ways in which they differ. And Coach McVay has a really fascinating offense. So I spent a ton of time. As soon as I agreed to do the gig, I was like, all right, I'm going to go back. I'm going to watch every Rams game. I'm going to study. Oh, okay. Like, sometimes, you know, all right, normally they're running duo in this situation where they usually run wide zone. I'm like, all this in my head. And then, you know, Jesse, show up preseason. The first thing I realize is, oh, they're not doing fucking any of that.
Yeah, like, they're not going to show anything.
All that time I spent thinking about this was like, here is the vanilla offense with Blake Bortles. Let me tell you this. In week three, we got word that Blake Bortles is going to play an entire half. And I was like, oh, yeah. And then I turned to Andrew. I was like, did I just say, oh, yeah, about watching an entire half of Blake Bortles like that playing football? Like, that's where I am right now. That was, although I actually, the Rams backup, who now is their backup and not Bortles, John Wolford, he's not from Kentucky. No, he's from NC, Wake Forest. Anyways, I think he's quite good.
You know, it's funny. You have your Blake Bortles moment. So we share an agent. Mike Klein is both of our agents. And he called me 2 weeks before the NFL season 2 years ago and said, Matt, ESPN wants you to host the Sunday morning NFL ESPN radio pregame show. And I was like, Mike, man, I don't really follow the NFL closely. I'm not the guy. He was like, well, you're going to learn to do it. So in 2 weeks, like, I read the Football Outsiders book to try to do it. First week of the year, all my friends are listening to, like, try to pump me up. And Blake Bortles is somehow the topic. And I'm, like, talking about Blake Bortles. And I had one of my friends write me and go, I've known you for 30-plus years, and I never knew you had any opinions about Blake Bortles, much less that passionate of a Blake Bortles opinion. So you and I both had our Blake Bortles moments. But I, just like you, I was very glad Mike talked me into it. It helped sort of elevate my career. And are you going to do them again this year?
I think so, yeah. A lot of stuff's kind of, you know, touch and go at the moment with kind of cutting to our earlier conversation, but I'm hoping to find the time to do it because it's just a great learning experience. I mean, we have so few opportunities at this age to really, like, it almost felt like going to college, like, you know, or doing like, yes, a crash course or something. Because just from a logistical standpoint, right? Like, you wear a lot of hats and, you know, every job requires new learning the ins and outs of hosting and, okay, you know.
And ESPN does everything on their own way. Like, you know, they have, yeah, their ESPN way. You can't, their big thing was you couldn't say welcome back. And I'm a big welcome back guy. Yeah, no. And they were like, you can't welcome back or coming up. And I would say welcome back all the time. And they would get in my ear and go, stop saying welcome back. And I'm like, why is it such a big deal? You don't say welcome back.
My first opportunity to do radio at ESPN, before I did TV, I did radio, which is kind of a common trajectory. First thing I did at ESPN was a podcast. I did my friend, the Bill Barnwell show. I came, yes, on every week to talk about football. And then, so my first radio opportunity after that was doing a fantasy football show on Sundays. Unfortunately, it was not, I know that's another common, like, entry point, you know, is,
and that's an even harder thing. Cause you got to know every player for that.
It's so different from football. I was like, all right, I know football. I, you know, come in, and it's like, nope, you got to go, like, Devonta Freeman PPR or, you know, targets, yes, or whatever. I used to go into that show with like 50 pages of research, and Carabel and Rothenberg were hosting. They'd be like, what are you doing? Like, you don't need to prepare this much.
Well, don't let Eric Carabel, my interactions with Eric Carabel on that show, I have him for 30 minutes every week. And he sits there and, like, he's like a savant on that stuff. Like,
oh, yeah,
he knows everything. And I don't know anything. And that's almost honestly how we do it. But I was with you my first day hosting the pregame show, Dan Orlovsky and Myron Metcalf are my co-hosts. And we did it in Bristol. And Dan Orlovsky, it was the first time he was ever on the radio. So he was,
wow,
like, he won't say this now because he's like Dan cool guy, but he was terrified. Like, he was really nervous. And so was, wow, I. Because I mean, this was my first time on national radio. I knew, yeah, Myron a little bit. I didn't know Dan at all.
Myron's great.
Dan's,
that's a good crew.
It was awesome. Dan is scared. I'm terrified. But I had this stack of notes. And Dan was like, why'd you bring all those notes? I was like, I don't know anybody. I don't know anyone on any roster. But soon you learn, oh, you, please, don't really need to.
Dan also, he might be a cool guy, but he prepares more than anyone. He works harder than just, yes, about, does, any, you know, former player analyst that I know.
After like 2 weeks doing that with Dan, I knew it was going to be 1 year with him. Because I knew he was going to, like, you knew he's going to be a star. Like, he's so, first of all, he's so pretty. Great. That's part of it. But he's also really good at everything. Like, you just kind of knew. So you're on Around the Horn. You're on some, I've seen you with Levitard stuff. It seems like that sort of younger group of folks, I know Bomani and Pablo a little bit. I don't know most of the rest of them. But it seems like everybody gets along really, really well in that whole ESPN group. Is that the case?
Yeah, definitely. I think Levitard in particular has done a really good job growing his coaching tree. I call it, I think, embarrassing when I say that, but it's a really cool group. It's a very diverse group. It is people with unconventional backgrounds. I mean, when I first met him was actually before I started doing TV, really. It sort of came in to do radio with him at first and then kind of worked my way up. But he immediately, I think, recognized something for me that I think I didn't. Gosh, you were asking me about friends and I somehow made this about me. I'm going to go back to answering your question. Totally fine.
Well, no, I mean, listen, yes, that Levitard group, like I saw, I remember seeing a video, like he got married or something and went to the wedding
last year,
and it was like an ESPN set at his wedding. So I could see that being the case.
Yeah, no, it's great. Pablo, I knew before, Pablo Torre, we're talking about, I knew before I started working at ESPN because we're about the same age and he used to work at Sports Illustrated when I worked at Fortune. Dominique Foxworth become one of my closest friends, frequent collaborators. He does a lot of stuff with Dan as well and has just been someone I've really loved working with. You know, in my position, having people like him, NFL players, and like Dan, who I guess, you know, it's really helpful to have guys like that on your side who validate your opinions and, because unfortunately it's still pretty needed and they've meant a lot to me in that capacity.
Well, let me ask you about it. Unfortunately, it's pretty needed. I mean, football is the most masculine of sports, at least in the listener base. I mean, there are, you know, I'm sure the other, all the sports to some extent are masculine, but football, it's, you know, people think of it as like the manly sport and you are entering that space. And I would imagine that there is just a group of people who don't listen or are skeptical of you. I'm sure you've had to deal with that. How do you deal with it? And do you think that's something that's getting better?
I do think it's getting better. I think it kind of goes back to that phrase we used at the beginning, the center has moved a little bit. I think people are just used to seeing me and some others in that, you know, working in that capacity, and it becomes kind of normalized, to be honest. When I first started at ESPN, I was mostly asked to talk about football when there was like a domestic violence story. I was rarely asked or invited to give analysis. And that's something not to like call out my own company or whatever, but that's something I, you know, worked my way into a bit, some through a mixture of getting opportunities and creating them, I suppose, myself, you know, doing a football podcast, doing podcasts with Bill. My listener base of my podcast, my football show, which I think it, other than our fantasy show, it's the biggest football show we've got. It's mostly men. And when I read the comments or listen to them, they're just great football questions. They just love the football talk. And I think it's pretty fucking cool that, you know, like the most popular show is a woman and a dog co-hosting a football show. Like that speaks to them more than, you know, as much as me, the fact that they're open-minded and interested in that. It's pretty neat. It makes me happy.
Yeah, the editor of my website, Tyler Thompson, is a young woman who I've watched our audience be better to her over the last 7 years. Like, I mean, she used to get these really nasty comments and it would anger me, but what are you going to do about it, right? Like, there's not a whole lot you can do. But I've watched over time as that, I really think the women in sports angle has advanced pretty quickly as well. And I think part of it to me is ESPN putting folks like you, and there's a lot of you all, but Sarah Spain, Katie Nolan, et cetera, in these prominent roles and not just standing there with the microphone reporting, no offense to the people that do that, but giving analysis. I do think that's got to have at least something to do with it, don't you?
Yeah, we all have really different roles too. You know, I mean, I think of those women that you mentioned, we all like have very different styles, but also different interests. I think I'm pretty like football is sort of my lane, but Sarah knows a hell of a lot more about baseball than I do, for example. But I think the kind of common, I suppose, feature of all the women that have been sort of putting those roles at ESPN is just kind of a willingness to do the work. I mean, the thing people don't see, I guess, when it comes to me and my approach is when I'm like a podcast for me usually has like 30 or 40 pages of note. If I'm going to talk about Drew Lock, I'm going to go back and watch his last six games. And
really, you're a 30 or 40 pages of notes person. Like, wow. See, like,
depends on what I'm doing.
I have no notes for this. Now you're making me feel like I wasn't ready. Well, but like, really?
No. I mean, I'm trying to be an NFL analyst. So, like on my podcast, every off season we start doing divisional previews, which is a great exercise for NFL. If you want to like get to know, you know, go depth chart by depth chart, look at all the off season moves and think that it's a shit ton of work, man. Like, so, you know, those are the things. I did this like work diary for New York Times like a couple months ago, and it was kind of an interesting exercise because I'm like, yeah, I'm doing it around the horn for an hour here, maybe doing radio, but most of my time is just studying and reading and taking notes on football, and it's kind of boring. But I've found that that served me well.
I'll admit I lied because I did do some research and I read your work diary. And my thought was that one thing you and I share in common is that we sort of are doing stuff from the time we get up to the time we get to sleep. There's not like a 9-to-5 situation. But you mentioned studying. You know, when I started that radio show, I was also opening a sports bar, and I would sit there while the construction was going on and read the Football Outsiders book. And there came a point I felt like almost overwhelmed by how much to do an NFL show well, how much you really needed to know. It's kind of unbelievable. I want to switch gears for a second. I will not make you comment on any of this specifically, but the people that listen to this know that over the years that since I've been doing ESPN stuff, I've had a couple of difficult interactions. My very first radio show, we'll talk about off the air, maybe the worst thing I've ever been a part of. And it was really because of the other person.
Oh, man.
And then one person I can name, because I've talked about it so much on the radio, is Sal Palantonio, is always really rude to me for some reason. I think he hates me, and I don't know why, because we've never had a negative interaction. But Dan Orlovsky sends me little Sal Palantonio, like he signs everything to me, Sal Palantonio, because that's how bad it was for a while. Without naming names, because I know you can't, do you have anybody like that? Is there anybody that when you see it on your call sheet or whatever?
I'll give you one.
Okay.
I'm not going to give you one, but there is someone who has me blocked and I don't know why.
Oh, at ESPN?
Yes.
You don't have to
and
say
I don't, don't I am not, no, I'm not going to say who, but I've barely interacted with them. Has that ever happened to you?
Oh yeah.
Where you see someone and they block you and sometimes usually I can guess. Why,
yeah.
Right? Usually, I mean, if it's a stranger too, like 9 times out of 10, it's a guy, you know, in his car wearing sunglasses and with the Abby with the dog peeking over. That's why I want to rescue all the dogs from the bad Abbies out there on Twitter. I want to start like a nonprofit. Let's rescue all the dogs with the bad like owners. But anyways, but sometimes you come across one and you're like, really?
Yeah,
like a real person, like a legitimate person, and you don't know why, and then it just you become obsessed.
I'm obsessed about Sal Palantonio. I don't know why he doesn't like me. I've never had one negative conversation with him, but every time he comes on, I think I'm doing the show again this year. If you ever flip on your radio and hear it, we have him on like every week. Myron can ask him a question, and he's like polite and happy.
Yeah.
Whoever I ask him something, and he like acts like he's talking to Saddam Hussein, and like I don't know, I have no idea why, but it I'm with you. It like perplexes me. I just want to go, what is wrong?
The only thing I know I've only met Sal once at the Super Bowl. Actually, the only thing I know is, oh, you know what? I met him twice at a different game. I can't remember, but teeth are so white. The whitest teeth I've ever seen. It's just shocking.
Do you have anyone that you've met in your thing that like was surprisingly nice? So for instance, I hosted a show one day with Mel Kiper, and I couldn't believe how nice Mel Kiper was. I'd watched him all these years with his hair. I didn't even really think of him as a human being. And he's like unbelievably nice. Have you had very anyone nice like that?
Yeah, a few amount of people. A lot of former NFL guys who I've been able to work with at ESPN have been super nice. I'm trying to think of one that's more surprising. I'll go with Louis Riddick, who people respect him, but you know, he's a pretty serious guy. And I think that comes across. But he's also been very kind to me behind the scenes. And so I think there's a little bit of, you know, not a disconnect, but he does come across as a very serious minded person.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about where we're going to be in, let's say, January. So I'm going to go through these sports. You tell me what you think they're going to look like. So we talked about pro football. What do you think is going to happen with college football? I mean, everyone in Kentucky is trying to guess. I don't think you can play college football without pro football. Let's assume pro happens. Does college happen in its full form in your mind?
Full form is kind of where you caught me there, because I do think it's going to happen. I still don't think there's going to be fans, certainly not anywhere close to what we're used to. About a month ago, if you had asked me, I would have said there's no way it happens widely without students. I've since changed my position as colleges have changed their position.
Well, they have gall that I didn't know they had. I used to say the same thing. I was like, they'll never make them play if students aren't there. And then I was like, oh, yes, they will. So,
yeah, I thought the shame might kick in, right? The fact that the jig is kind of up if you do that. But I think they're going to be able to leverage the fact that most of the kids want to play, which of course they want to play. Come on. No, they're not going to say they're not. But I think very few colleges are going to abstain. Unfortunately, Michigan's got the president who's like an immunologist or something.
Yes. Well, he might be the one. USC today announced they're going to play today. And that's, I mean, and cynical me says the reason USC is going to play is they've got their once in a lifetime game with Alabama and they ain't going to miss it. You know, like they don't want to, you know, they don't want that getting canceled. I mean, do you think that's part of it? Is it's just these athletic departments have to play? They don't have a choice. Mm. Their whole budget depends on it.
You mean to tell me colleges are motivated by money? Are you sure you want to say that in a public platform?
Yes, I think we can do that.
I think you're right.
It does look to me like baseball may not happen, though, which is kind of amazing because
I think it'll happen.
You think it'll happen?
Yeah, I think this is a lot of posturing.
Well, but what do you think it ends up with? I mean, you know, they started with 82 and then the players wanted 114. The owners want 50. Does that mean we get right back to 82 and it's right where it was when it started?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. The owners have given in on the prorating stuff, which is what the players originally wanted. Their big concern, the owners, is the postseason. That's where they make a ton of their money, right? And so they're very worried. They want to hit. It's part of the reason they wanted to go away from the prorated thing in the first place was they wanted to hedge against, what if we don't have a postseason? Then we're really screwed. So I think they might build in some kind of protections in that regard, perhaps some deferrals. But I just think this is how MLB and MLBPA, like, this is just their dynamic. It just looks weird now. It's strange now that they're treating this like a normal negotiation, like a CBA negotiation, and these are not normal times. And it's at a moment when, like, the NBA and their union are moving in lockstep as they usually do, and all this is happening. It's a little bit, or that hockey came to, you know, an agreement fairly quickly. It feels weird, but it's actually not normal. It's just that the time is not normal. Like, their behavior, the fact that this kind of conflict is happening, is totally normal for baseball.
NBA. They're going to finish this year and do whatever they do. But do you think now we're going to start to where for years in the future, they always start the season at Christmas and it becomes kind of a spring summer sport and sort of gets itself completely away from football altogether?
That's something they've been talking about for a while. It's something that, you know, Silver's been kicking around. And I think it's possible. I mean, the NBA certainly seems to have a willingness to experiment and kind of push the envelope on some of these formats that they've been rumored to be considering for a minute. Oh, midseason tournament, reseeding, 1-16, all that stuff. I will say, though, they didn't really do any of that for the playoff format. It's actually pretty conventional, right? What they end up deciding on, the 22 teams with a possible play-in. They didn't reseed either. So they might be a little bit anxious about bringing on too much change at the moment too quickly, but I certainly think it's on the table.
I think they have to be careful, like Bomani said on this podcast last week, because they've got a year where LeBron can win it with the Lakers, and they don't want it to be looking like it's at all cheesy or it's at all like – I think if LeBron wasn't with the Lakers, I think that's part of it. Do you?
Yeah, totally. I mean, come on. It's interesting to me that more people aren't raising a little bit of an eyebrow at the fact that the players aren't even voting. Like, Michelle Roberts said, oh, you know, we've got a task force and that's collectively bargaining. What?
Yeah.
So you're just letting the stars like decide this.
And the stars have different incentives. And the stars have way different incentives
than teams
than the average player. Yeah. That's right. All right. I'll finish with this two questions.
Yeah.
I always ask people that aren't on with me a lot, when I say Kentucky, since a lot of this audience is going to be Kentucky, what comes to your mind is, it doesn't just have to be sports, but sports or whatever. I'm always interested in the view of folks with no connection to the state to where we are.
Sure. Louisville. That was last time I was in Kentucky. It was Lamar Jackson's pro day. So what was that, 2018? Okay. So I haven't been to Kentucky in 2 years. So that was that.
Great kid.
Fun pro day.
Even though he played for the rival school, me, along with like Michael Vick, maybe Reggie Bush, Cam Newton, like he was to me one of the most eye-opening players I've ever seen in college sports.
Do you guys have any? Who was your highest drafted player this year?
Well, we had Josh Allen a couple years ago. To Jacksonville. This year it was Lynn Bowden. Went to Oakland.
Oh, Lynn Bowden. Oh, he's fun.
Yes.
He is fun. I love Josh Allen. We call Josh Allen good Josh Allen amongst certain NFL circles. I hope no Bills fans are listening because they really hate that.
Well, he's a great dude.
He's a great player.
And he's a great guy.
Oh, that's good to hear.
Yeah, he's a great guy. All these guys have come out. Za'Darius Smith, who went to Kentucky, mm-hmm. who's with Green Bay. He's a great guy. I'm so happy he has success because he played on two really terrible Kentucky teams, but has had – a ton of success as well. So I want to ask you this, because this is for Maggie and all of our younger writers. If you were giving them advice as to how to sort of go through their career, because it's a different thing. I say this to people all the time. People ask me, well, how do you get to where you are? I lucked into it. I was a lawyer that backed into it. But also the whole business has completely changed even since I've been doing it. What advice would you give a young woman who's wanting to be the next Mina Kimes and be on all your platforms?
Pick a sport and study the hell out of it. I think that's something that's not said enough. And, you know, we're all generalists now. I'm a generalist. I was just not around the horn talking about, you know, the NBA and such. But having a home base in football, in the NFL in particular, and spending the time to feel comfortable, not just comfortable, not feeling like I can fit in, but going into a conversation on ESPN, on one of our shows, and feeling like I know more about the NFL than everyone at the table has been my greatest, I guess, my greatest asset. And, you know, I'm certainly sitting at a lot of tables where that's not the case, but that comfort level has given me the confidence to develop the other sides of doing my job, which were not things that came naturally to me, like, you know, talking, being on TV, wearing makeup, all that stuff.
Yeah. And it sure helps a lot if it's the NFL. I mean, Mike Klein said to me, Matt, you can't do college stuff all day. You're going to at some point have to pick. And the NFL does open up. There's nothing like the NFL, especially at ESPN, don't you think?
I love it. I love the NFL. It's a complicated love affair, and I certainly get asked about that a lot. Every time there's a negative story, hell, it's certainly a question right now as we consider all the Colin Kaepernick stuff, but I still, nothing makes me happier than sitting down on a Sunday and just watching hours and hours of football until my butt's glued to my couch.
Well, Mina, thank you very much for your time. We appreciate it. We'll have to have you on maybe again during NFL season. Everybody listen to her podcast, The Daily. Folks, tell people really quick what you do every morning.
Sure. Yeah. So I do the football show on Tuesdays, but then every day I host a show called ESPN Daily. Please subscribe. It's a different sports story every day. It's about 20 minutes, real quick. Mixture of like the big stories, like, okay, we're gonna talk about the NBA tournament with Zach Lowe, and weird stories like tomorrow, our episode, I don't know when it's coming out, Thursday, our episode is about how Andre Dawson runs a funeral home now in Florida.
I saw crazy. He said running a funeral home. Yeah.
He's great. I love him. So that, and then just every day I'm on either Around the Horn or Highly Questionable.
Yeah, so I said The Daily. That's the New York Times ones, but it's ESPN Daily. But they're both good, actually. We appreciate it. Thank you very much.